which will be Howard Moss talking on the class divide and the role of the trade unions. Just to reiterate what was said previously, this is at least nominally a hybrid meeting, so it's being recorded, and we've got a microphone for the speaker. Apologies to the people listening at home, as Paddy's just put in the chat, that we're not properly set up for hybrids, so we don't have a roving mic, so that during the contributions from the floor, we're not going to be able to pick up what's said very much. We'll do our best, and you'll certainly hear Howard's responses, and we'll try and do our best to make sure that you have some gist of what's going on in the room. If people want to make questions via the chat, I will be able to see them, and I'll try and take them first if people want to then escape quickly because they can't hear what's going on in the rest of the floor discussion. Okay, right. Thank you all very much, and over to Howard to begin his talk.
Thanks, Bill. Just to say, first of all, the technology for this talk is good old-fashioned handouts, which I've put on seats, so people should have those. Now, unfortunately, the people on Discord won't see them, but everything on the handouts, I am actually going to read out in the course of the talk. So the people on Discord, the members on Discord, won't miss anything, okay? If those on Discord, if something happens to the voice, can somebody sort of pipe up on Discord and say so, and we'll see if we can remedy that. But as I understand it, at this moment, they can hear what's being said, which is obviously good. Okay, well, the class divide and the role of trade unions. I'll start on a personal note. I wrote an article for the December 2020 Socialist Standard entitled 50 Years in the Party, I'm afraid. The title was obviously self-explanatory, but there was one short section of it which the editors decided to subtitle Trade Union Activity. And if you'll bear with me a moment, I'll just read a bit of that section out. It's the first one on your handout. Number one, is it? Yeah, number one on your handout. It says, the 1990s were a bit of an anti-climax in party activity, for me anyway. I was still active in trying to drum up interest in socialism at a local level and attended regular branch meetings. This was a period, too, when I started to involve myself in trade union activity in my place of work. It was something I found extremely satisfying and still do. That's because you often saw quick results in terms of helping to resolve people's problems at work, both individually and collectively, and felt you were making some kind of immediate difference, however small. For me, it complemented the longer-term project of spreading socialist ideas in society at large and fitted in well with the party's view of trade unionism as a necessary form of resistance to the tendency of capitalism to take for itself an increasingly large share of the surplus value produced by workers. It also made me fully conscious, if I wasn't already, of the need for trade unions to be fully independent of political parties and groups and not to succumb to the will of the union's politicos, that is, those from the left-wing, largely Trotskyist groups, who were small in number, but by being activists, could still dominate union decision-making and use their position to promote their own political ends, rather than for the benefit of members. They would, and still do, constantly seek to bounce members into industrial action, even when such action is more likely to be damaging than successful. Full stop. Now, maybe I could actually just stop there, because that says, or at least sums up what I have to say about trade unions and what the party has to say. But I won't stop there, actually. I'll carry on for a bit, about half an hour, something like that. OK. And since the overall subject of this week's gathering is the class divide, I'll first say something that's pretty obvious. And I hope you won't find that a lot of this is too much coals to Newcastle. So the first thing I'll say is that the root of the socialist case lies in class. It goes something like this. In capitalist society, there are, broadly speaking, two classes of people. Firstly, there's one class, the capitalist class, who own or control enough profit-derived wealth to be able to live off that wealth without having to work to survive, if they choose not to. Then there's another class of people, much larger, the vast majority, in fact, who can be called the working class. And that's because they're obliged to work in order to survive. They're obliged on pain of destitution or severe suffering anyway to sell their energies, mental and or physical, to an employer for a wage or salary. And the employee is either a member of or an agent of the capitalist class. In this view, the working class is not just what it's often conceived of as in the popular vision, that is, those in manual or low-skilled work, or who are from especially poor or disadvantaged backgrounds. Rather, it's all those who have to work for a wage or salary for a living. So, for example, engineers, teachers, doctors, lawyers, computer scientists, etc., as well as delivery drivers, refuse collectors, construction workers, railway employees, cleaners, shop workers, etc. So, as the Socialist Party's first ever manifesto said in 1905, and I've sort of got a copy of it here, although this is the reprint from 1906, as it says, and this is, I think, number two on your handout, society is today divided into two classes with opposing interests, one class owning the means of life and the other nothing but their power to work. Now, this definition of class is, of course, a generalisation, and people often try to pick holes in it. They point out, for example, that some people fall into neither category. They are neither capitalists nor workers as defined above, but may, for example, be self-employed individuals working for themselves or, in some parts of the world, say, peasants living off the land that they own or what it produces. People may also point to extremely well-paid workers, such as company executives, top-class professional footballers, whose employment allows them to accumulate enough wealth to live comfortably now and into the future without having to work and maybe without being capitalist, strictly speaking. But these are only, in fact, a tiny minority of any population, and this clearly doesn't invalidate the overall definition of class division adopted by socialists. So given this class division and the antagonism of interest between the two classes that it causes, what's necessary, so the socialist case continues, is for the vast majority of people, that is, the workers, to take political action, ideally via elections, to dissolve the antagonism by abolishing the money and wages system which the current society, capitalism, is based on. The socialist argument is that there is, and there has been for quite some time now, sufficient potential abundance for capitalism to be replaced on a global scale by a system in which the whole of humanity can fulfil themselves in a democratic cooperative society of voluntary work with free access to all goods and services on the basis of from each according to ability to each according to need. However, the reality we're all aware of is that this shows little sign of happening at the moment. So the question that naturally arises is, what do we do? What do those who want this to happen do in the meantime? Well, one thing we as socialists and the Socialist Party do in the meantime, in fact, the main thing, is to try and spread the idea that the way society is currently organised is not in the majority interest, and so persuade those who will listen of the need for majority political action to change that and to establish a socialist society. For the moment, at least, this, as I say, falls mainly on deaf ears. We're all aware of that. I think we are anyway. But when it doesn't, the response we get from at least some of those who like the idea, but think, well, it's going to take a long time, their argument can be, we need to do something other than try and spread the idea in the famous meantime. And of course, most of us know what this in the meantime means to most people who suggest it. It means that we should appeal to governments to reform the current system, to make things a bit better here and now under capitalism. We, of course, react to this by arguing that that's a thankless task, that there's so much wrong with the capitalist, profit-based, money-driven system we're forced to live in, that the well of reforms that would be needed, even to improve it a bit, are pretty bottomless. And anyway, because of capitalism's nature, it would be impossible for the system to deliver even a small proportion of what's needed. And in any case, if we were to start embarking on reforms here and there, as many do, our time and energies would quickly be taken up with this, and the idea of a future qualitatively different society would quickly fall into the background and probably be forgotten about. And a further argument, of course, is that no reforms of capitalism by governments, even the most drastic ones, could come close to constituting the kind of society that socialists advocate. In the end, governments have to give priority to profit-making. And in the end, the system rules governments, not the other way around. This was very well illustrated, I thought, in this month's Socialist Standard, in the editorial to this month's Standard, which got somewhere, talks about climate change. And it says that to do anything serious about climate change, the warring politicians would have to pull the plug on capitalism itself. They're obviously not going to do that. So reforms won't cut it. A definite no to reformism then, as far as we're concerned. But this talk isn't about reformism or otherwise. It's about the role of unions. And so what about action within capitalism by workers simply to improve the employment situation which we're forced to be in? That is via collective action in trade unions. That's the topic of this session. So I'll sort of move more specifically onto that now. Well, just to go back a bit, from the 19th century onwards, workers began to unite in voluntary organisations to negotiate the built-in antagonisms between themselves and their employers that I've referred to. The idea was not, of course, to take action to do away with paid employment and establish socialism, which most of them knew nothing about. Their idea was not to try and transcend the class divide, but to take collective action to enable themselves to get as good a deal as possible in selling their energies and skills to their employers, since it was clear that efforts by individuals, by people on their own, weren't going to get far, stood no real chance. Initially, collective action by workers was sternly opposed by governments acting in the interests of the employing class, and that, of course, was and still is their function. The kind of action I'm talking about is such as that commemorated by the annual trade union festival at Tolpuddle, the Tolpuddle Martyrs Festival. This remembers six farm labourers who were arrested and transported to Australia in 1834 for trying to organise a union to try and combat cuts to their wages. This festival, by the way, is usually attended by a group of our members, as was this year's, which took place last month. You may have seen pictures of them if you look on the party's Facebook site. Anyway, gradually, through perseverance and changed conditions, unions did come to be granted legal status and were able, through collective action and despite continued resistance from employers and the state, to secure some incremental and ongoing improvements to their pay and working conditions, even if sometimes these were temporary or short-lived. So it was maybe sort of two steps forward, one step back, or sometimes even the other way around. But as I said, it was a gradual process. Some of these early struggles are well summed up in some of the Socialist Party's earliest publications, in the first manifesto, which I've mentioned, from 1905, which was then republished a number of times after. The party's 1932 pamphlet, which went into this, the Socialist Party of Great Britain and Questions of the Day, and in particular this pamphlet, which some members will remember, specifically on trade unions. It's not been updated or republished for quite some time. The 1905 manifesto used some colourful language of the type we probably wouldn't use today, but some of it's quite exhilarating, and this is on your handout, Mike, sort of yours, sorry. It's number three on the handout. First of all, about wages, it says, long experience has shown that in practice wages slide down with express speed, but the sliding up process proceeds at a tortoise-like rate. Nice and colourful, I think. Anyway, and how prescient that is, how up-to-date. About the gradual nature of union, the gradual progress of unions, while the employers were numerous and competing, the workers' unions were able to wring advantages from them and make employment a little less like the hellish slavery it had been. Nice expression, that, hellish slavery. Then about the union's conflict of interest with employers and other political parties, before the trade unions can become effective factors in bringing about a change of society, they must give up the superstition that the robbers can be friendly to the robbed. The other superstition, that the employer is an enemy on the industrial field, but a friend on the political field, must also be abandoned. But the question that then has arisen for the party is this. Cannot operating on the industrial field for improvements, even minor ones, within the system, be seen itself as a kind of reformism? And so, given that the party does not advocate reforms, should socialists support it? Well, ever since the SPGB was founded 118 years ago, this is a question that's been asked within the party, at least intermittently. Bob Baltrop's History of the Party, The Monument, I reread it recently. It's still a fantastic read, by the way. People haven't read it or want to reread it, The Monument. Baltrop explains very well the concerns that the party's founders had over the correct attitude to trade unions. Much theorising and soul-searching took place, and again, it's something dealt with in that very first manifesto from 1905 and at some length. And the manifesto states, and this is number four on the handout, the basis of the action of trade unions must be a clear recognition of the position of workers under capitalism and the class struggle resulting therefrom. All actions of the union in support of capitalism or tending to sidetrack the workers from the only path that could lead to their emancipation should be strongly opposed. But on the other hand, trade unions being a necessity under capitalism, any action on their part upon sound lines should be clearly supported. In other words, no political involvement by unions, but a function in a limited sphere on sound lines. And that can only mean sound economic lines. This matter is also well documented in Dave Perrin's book, which some of you or most of you will know, The Socialist Party of Great Britain, Politics, Economics and Britain's Oldest Socialist Party. Again, well worth a read if you've not already read it. And this shows how the outcome of debates on this matter within the party has always yielded the decision that trade union action should be differentiated from reformism in that its fundamental purpose is to secure from the employing class a larger share of the surplus value that workers generate, even if in practice that share is only ever likely to be slightly larger than before. A particular what might be called borderline case between reformism and trade union action is explained by Dave Perrin in his chapter on the welfare state. It talks about the 1942 Beveridge Report, which paved the way for what became known as the welfare state. The author explains that one of the things that exercised the party in particular was the proposal for what came to be called family allowances. That is the recommendation by a government commission to introduce payment to families with dependent children at the rate of 8 shillings per week. The left and the trade unions were delighted. They called this a socialist measure and gave it their support. But the party opposed it, not because it regarded it simply as an element of reformism, but because the party saw it as a way to cut real wages and increase profits, and so, in fact, to lower not to improve working class living standards. How was that? What's the argument here? Well, the party's 1943 pamphlet, Family Allowances, a Socialist Analysis, which you'll see cost 2D, two old pence. This pamphlet from 1943 argued that family allowances would in fact result in a reduction in the total national wage bill for the government and the owning class it represented. It explained it as follows, and this is number 5 on your handout. As soon as the cost for perhaps more truly or perhaps more truly the alleged cost of rearing some or all of the workers' children is considered by the employers to have been provided for outside of wages, the tendency will assert itself for wages to sink to a new level based on the cost of maintaining a worker and his wife, or a worker, his wife and one child, as the case may be. Obviously using a Marxist analysis here. So this was simply a momentary false inducement. And despite appearances, the party argued that it should not be supported by trade unions, whose job it was to make sure that the working class got more, not less, within capitalism. So though the Socialist Party sees workers organising in trade unions as a necessary and beneficial way of struggling in a class-divided society to maintain and, if possible, to improve pay and conditions, family allowances were not seen to be about that. They were seen to be just another reform, which, apart from actually making some workers worse off in the long term, would do nothing to change the antagonism of interests between workers and capitalists. And today, in the system's more advanced stage, that antagonism is, of course, still there and shows no signs of changing, nor can it change, because it's an integral part of the system of workers selling their energies to an employer for a wage or salary. And it pits the interests of one class against the interests of the other. So the organisations that exist to defend workers' interests, unions, are a necessary and inevitable feature of capitalism, even if they aren't always successful in effectively defending those interests. It follows from this that membership of trade unions is something the Socialist Party encourages, and it supports it both for its own members and for the working class as a whole. But what actually happens on the ground? Well, the reality is that many workers, the majority, in fact, at the moment, if we take this country as an example, choose not to be in trade unions. In 2021, so-called union density stood at 23.1%. That's around 6.4 million workers. And it's gone down a lot since its peak in 1979, when 13.2 million workers were in trade unions. So it's more than half since then. The best one can say is that in recent times, the rate of decline has slowed down. So the majority of workers are not union members. But do they in fact lose by this? Well, we would argue that they do. Why? Well, it's true that non-members, non-trade union members, do get so-called free rider benefits when trade unions in a workplace manage to gain wage rises or improve conditions for their members, because those benefits also extend to other workers who are not union members and don't pay their dues. But in a broader sense, non-members also lose, because the fact is that the more people in a workplace who are members and prepared to take industrial action in support of their claims, the more likely it is that the employer will at least negotiate for fear of potential disruption and lost profit, and that workers will get a little more. In other words, numerical strength is usually a highly relevant factor when it comes to bargaining and trade union action. I'll also mention something I mentioned earlier that might be called political trade unionism. I mentioned it with reference to the 50 years in the party article. This is where unions or union members involve themselves in not just trying to protect or improve pay and working conditions, but instead are either used as vehicles for campaigning for various reforms of capitalism, or they're used by Trotskyist groups for so-called consciousness raising. The Socialist Party has always been
resolutely opposed to the use of trade unions for these purposes. With regard to the Labour Party in particular, over the years we've seen the effectiveness of trade union action adversely affected by its support for Labour. This kind of support gets justified by the contention that Labour is the political arm of the trade union movement. And as we know, the Labour Party was originally formed from the trade union movement at the beginning of the last century. And there are continuing close links, with the largest unions are still affiliated to the Labour Party, and Labour is still heavily reliant on these unions for funding. For the last general election, it received £5 million from the unions. In addition to this, we've also seen trade unions used quite a lot as a sort of jumping off ground for Labour politicians. We've seen a lot of that over the years, a bit less so today, but certainly been the case traditionally. But the experience of all the Labour administrations running capitalism since the Second World War has shown that on the industrial field, Labour governments, far from using their political power to exert influence, to exert pressure on employers to grant wage increases or better conditions, they've actually quite often used their power against workers in various ways, in particular to impose so-called wage restraint. Again, this is well documented in the various pamphlets the party's produced covering this topic over the years. Some of the many examples of anti-trade union action by the Labour Party are detailed, for instance, in the party's 1953 edition of this pamphlet, Questions of the Day, One Shilling, and in the chapter on trade unionism in the 1968 pamphlet entitled Labour Government or Socialism. And then in the party's pamphlet I've already mentioned on trade unions. As I say, not just the Tory party, not just Tory governments, but Labour governments too have often acted against workers when they've been in power, and sometimes in fact used the police and even the army to break strikes. And this has gone into in some detail in this pamphlet that was produced shortly after the 1984-5 miners' strike, talked about what the Tory government at the time did, but it also went back in history to show what Labour had done when it came to supporting or opposing workers who were on strike. More generally, too, trade union effectiveness has been blurred by, been blunted, in fact, by the extent to which the unions have associated themselves with Labour governments in endorsing and carrying out their economic policies. At the very least, this kind of thing distracts what should be the principal purpose of trade unions, that is to resist the pressure of the capitalist class on workers' pay and conditions. The party's trade unions pamphlet, although now out of date, in certain ways anyway, expresses this extremely clearly. This is the one here. And this is number 6 on your handout. It says, in the struggle of the working class against the employers, it is not in the workers' interest that their unions should affiliate to or support the Labour Party or any other political party which is committed to administering the capitalist system. In order to be effective, trade unions have to seek to organise all workers, irrespective of the fact that they are divided in their political views. At the May 1979 general election, more workers and possibly more trade unionists voted Tory and Liberal than voted Labour. Tying the unions to any of these, to one of the other of the parties, and this is the key thing, I've interpolated that, promotes division, not unity. It's not beneficial either for workers when unions get used for political ends by other political groups who see an advantage in manipulating or controlling them. These are usually small left-wing Trotskyist groups who work in trade unions to further their own political ends and sometimes manage to have influence far in excess of their numbers. This usually means urging workers to strike come what may as a kind of article of faith.
it's an approach that can only be detrimental to workers. But the Trotskyists view industrial action not as the last line of defence that it should be, but as a sort of consciousness-raising operation, a kind of a rehearsal for bigger struggles to come, when the vanguard these groups see themselves as will lead the workers to a different society. And that's a society in which they see the state as playing an overriding role. And they often call socialism that, even though it actually bears no relation to the kind of socialism that the Socialist Party stands for. So, to be clear, the role or function of trade unions within capitalism bears no relation to the kind of social revolution we are looking for. That's a revolution that has to be sought in the political arena, where the real power of the capitalist class lies via its control of the state machine. And this is an idea which has been widely expressed in various of the party's publications, but there's a particularly effective expression of it on a number of occasions in the book which was produced by an old stalwart of the party, Samuel Late, in this book called World Without Wages, Money, Poverty and War, produced by the World Socialist Party of the United States. It's the text of a series of radio broadcasts, and it's marked by tremendous clarity, both in ideas and expression. Don't know if it's available for sale outside. Very well worth a read if people haven't read it. Short but very, very pithy pieces on all sorts of aspects of capitalism and socialism. The final point I would make relates to the glaring fact that almost all disputes at work are driven by one overriding factor, and that is money. The employing class or its agents are constantly seeking to find ways of maintaining or increasing the amount of money or profit that their enterprise can yield for them, or in running the services that maintain the profit system as economically as possible. The employee class, the workers, for their part, have only one real means of defending, or if possible, improving their conditions of work or living standards, and that is strike action, or the threat of strike action, basically going mob-handed to the employer. So what about strike action then? We do, of course, support and advocate strike action when it's likely to be effective. But obviously, unlike the Trotskyists, not for the sake of it. And we do recommend that workers put up the utmost resistance to the worsening of their conditions, as we all know is happening, for example, right now, with inflation far outstripping wage rises. But workers need to take action when it's likely to be useful for them to do so. And above all, it has to be the outcome of a genuine democratic decision amongst them. As Samuel Late in the book I've just mentioned wrote in the book World Without War, and this is number 7 on your sheet, strikes must be used with discretion and forethought. Timing is most important. When business conditions are good, with profits running high, a strike might prove more effective, not the reverse. Very wise words. And there's an interesting confirmation of this, actually, in this month's Socialist Standard, this very month's Socialist Standard, August 2022, in one of the Cooking the Books columns, which states, and this is it's not on your handout, I'm afraid. Should be, but it's not. Okay, it states, when negotiating, unions take into account whether an employer can pay. They are not so stupid as to insist on a claim that would bankrupt an employer with the result that members lose their jobs. I'll also add that the party itself has just issued the following statement on the current government's latest attempt at union bashing. That is, its intention to allow agency workers to replace striking workers as a result of the current series of transport strikes. And this is number 8 on your handout. This is the EC's recent statement. We are approaching a new phase in a long history of anti-union legislation from both Tory and Labour governments. the SPGB opposes any attempt to restrict workers' ability to take collective action to protect or improve conditions of employment. We urge all of our fellow workers to join an appropriate union, but remind them that this can only ever be a defensive response, that equity is not possible for wage slaves, that the only way to ensure sustained well-being for us all is by replacing the crazed pursuit of profit for the few with a classless society of cooperation where everything is produced solely to meet human needs. And experience has shown, and we must bear this in mind, that contrary to the view of the Trotskyists, there is no evidence that industrial action, whatever its outcome, is itself likely to be an instrument of any particular spread of consciousness. And the idea that some anarcho-syndicalists have that workers should use a general strike to take and hold the means of production is also a non-starter, since it fails to recognise the political action needed to overthrow capitalism. At the same time, we do need to keep pointing out that though under capitalism, the pressure on workers is inevitable and workers should try their best to apply the brake to worsening conditions by their trade unions, they have to also look beyond that and seek to abolish the system that gives rise to their conditions. And in this connection, I'll end by quoting something Marx wrote 150 years ago in a warning about action by unions and its effects in capitalism. And this is number 9 on your handout. It's from Wages, Price and Profit. The working class ought not to exaggerate to themselves the ultimate working of these everyday struggles. They ought not to forget that they are fighting with effects, that they are applying palliatives, not curing the malady. Pretty impossible to argue against this, I would contend. Pretty hard to argue that what Marx wrote then isn't just as true today. Thanks for listening.